So the Supreme Court ruling on marriage equality Friday was incredibly good news. It's an issue that State of Belief host Welton Gaddy and Interfaith Alliance have been working on for many years. But the news came too late for us to be able to cover it on this week's pre-recorded show. As we celebrate this milestone decision, we're already getting ready to discuss the significance of the ruling on next week's State of Belief.
From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. This program would not be possible without the generous support of State of Belief listeners. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. On our Interfaith calendar, Sunday is the Christian Feast of Saints Peter and Paul. Thursday brings the Buddhist observance of Asalhu Puja Day, and the Muslim holy month of Ramadan continues until July 17th. Now, here's what's coming up on State of Belief.
People from all walks of life came together at Unity Church of Charleston. Blacks and whites, Christians and Muslims, they were all bound together by the tragedy that will forever remain in their hearts.
Soon after the bloody massacre at the historic Emmanuel AME Zion Church in Charleston, South Carolina, news reports were full of the unbelievably moving words from surviving family members of the victims, the profoundly spiritual tone that has pervaded the aftermath of the June 17 tragedy extends far beyond those most immediately affected. The first interfaith vigil of unity and remembrance took place on Saturday at the Unity Church of Charleston. And on this week's show, I'll talk to Pastor Ed Kozak and organizer Cookie Washington.
I was a marked man, a Muslim who was not only openly gay, but had also been publicly labeled an infidel.
Imagine yourself as a committed Muslim who is also a gay man. Now imagine that you're a longtime public figure in both those communities, and you're going to make the Hajj, the compulsory pilgrimage to Mecca. Oh yeah, and you're also a filmmaker who plans to document the journey, which will take you into some pretty anti-gay places. On this week's show, you'll meet the man who lived this experience when I'm joined by Parvez Sharma. Also, our producer attends EuroPride 2015 in Riga, Latvia, and lives to tell about it. We'll get some impressions from our own Ray Kirstein. But first,
extraordinarily, they called it a hate crime, and some look at it as, well, it's because it was a white guy, apparently, and a black church. But you made a great point just a moment ago about the hostility toward Christians. And it was a church.
Right after the racist murder of 9 African Americans in Charleston, South Carolina, Professor Anthea Butler published a powerful commentary on language and justice in the Washington Post. The piece was headlined, "Shooters of Color Are Called Terrorists and Thugs. Why Are White Shooters Called Mentally Ill?" It prompted me to invite Dr. Butler to be with us again on State of Belief Radio. Anthea, I really appreciate you saying yes and being with us today.
Absolutely. Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
You write about how Charleston made racist media coverage around mass shootings fall apart. What do you mean by that?
Well, I meant that it would be very hard to just say that someone who came into a black church and shot and killed 9 people after sitting with them in a Bible study was mentally ill. I mean, he had a choice, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I just had been seeing all these things roll out time and time again after mass shootings. And white shooters were called mentally ill, you know, shooters of color or terrorists. It just really stuck out to me. Mm-hmm. And I started thinking about this when reports had started coming out late Wednesday night and early Thursday morning, and I thought, this is the problem.
I guess the two questions that I have related to that is, how conscious do you think this distinction is, or is part of it an unconscious racism?
Oh, I think it's both conscious and unconscious racism, and let me explain. I mean, I think for some media outlets, this is just the language. Everybody starts thinking about, well, what could have happened? Was he mentally ill? Was he sick? Was he this? Was he that? But you just see this sort of disposition to immediately go to the word thug or terrorist, mm-hmm. if it's, you know, something that happens with a Muslim extremist, or what has been happening lately with people being arrested for trying to join ISIS or incite something. They're immediately terrorists. I knew that this narrative was going to start to happen, and I saw it rolling out in real time on Twitter with some of the media people, and it troubled me. And the part that I think is overt is, and I'll be blunt about this because I think this is really important in this discussion, is to talk about outlets like Fox Media and others that mm-hmm. continue to sort of have a certain kind of drumbeat about people of color and Muslims mm-hmm. vis-a-vis white people. Mm-hmm. And it's very clear, and it's very racist. And I think that we have tried to pretend to have a very polite society about these things, mm-hmm. but it's just time to make this really plain mm-hmm. and to say, why are we doing this? And let's ask this question directly.
Would you talk specifically about the effects of the differences in coverage that you identify in your article?
Immediately, the kinds of things that started to happen was, we don't know his motive. Even Jeb Bush said this. Jeb
yes.
Bush said on Thursday, we don't know his motives. After everybody's talking about Emmanuel AME as a historic black church, you know, he shot someone who was in the state Senate. We don't know what his motive is. Well, he didn't walk into a white church. Mm-hmm. He didn't walk into Burger King. Or they got him some food at Burger King. He didn't walk into there. There's all these other places he could have gone if he was just a random, I feel crazy kind of person. I need to shoot people up. Okay.
Yeah.
And then there was this other narrative that happened. It's not related to the terrorist narrative, but I think it's really important to bring up, that happened on Fox News, and they had Alveda King on. And basically it was the narrative of, this wasn't a racialized shooting. It was about persecution of Christians. And there's nothing that has come out in Dylann Roof's manifesto or anything that he's written that this was about Christianity. It's been pure and simple about hatred of black people.
Mm-hmm.
So these narratives that get constructed in the media immediately after shootings that are perpetrated by white shooters are narratives that are designed to shuffle blame onto something else. The mentally ill thing gets used not just for race, but it also gets used for guns. So that you can mm-hmm. say, that's a mentally ill person with a gun. You know, we don't have to have gun control because not everybody's mentally ill.
Mm-hmm. What kind of response have you got? Have people been understanding, or have they been trying to refute what you said?
There have been a lot of people who've been understanding. The bad part is the people who want to argue with me on Twitter or emailing me saying, this is not true, and I'm a race baiter, and I'm dividing the races because I'm talking about race. And I always say back to these people, this is my job. I teach race. I teach history of American religion and African-American religious history. You can't teach those histories without talking about racism in America.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the people who push back on me are people who believe we shouldn't, A, talk about race, and B, that it's racist to talk about race, mm-hmm. and C, they're uncomfortable mm-hmm. because it's true.
There's been a surprising amount of discussion about getting rid of symbols of our racist past in Charleston and elsewhere. I'm interested in how you see that. Do you see those as a positive sign, or as more of a distraction from addressing deeper issues related to race?
I think both. I mean, I think it's a positive sign. What I'm very sad about is that it took the deaths of nine people and Emmanuel AME to have that happen. The second thing is that it's past time for those flags to come down, because anybody who has enough sense and wants to know some real history knows what the history of that flag is, and knows how the resurgence in 48 forward, after, you know, the Southern Dixiecrats split away from the Democratic Party and wanted to hold their own convention.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that it's a real realization, especially for the people who have clung to the Confederate flag, that there's a moment you need to let go of those racist symbols. And seeing Dylann Roof posing with all these pictures with the Confederate flag and a gun and all these kinds of other poses he had and the kinds of racist things that he was saying, I think that that's made people have to have a reckoning with what they thought was just their culture and their history. I also think, too, that, you know, America is the kind of place where we don't spend a lot of time thinking about how racism has come about, why we're in the situation we're in.
I have a fear. We've been here before related to race, related to guns, related to symbols. And we seem to focus on it for a while and then move on to something else. Is there a reason you can encourage me to say this time is different?
The difference about this is, I think, and, you know, this is State of Belief Radio, mm-hmm. is that this happened in a church.
Mm-hmm.
And it happened in a black church. And no matter what you think in America, the black church is a symbol for people. Whether you're racist or not, it's a symbol. If you're racist, it's a symbol of, you know, this is a place where black people agitate. If you're Christian, this is where black people congregate because they couldn't congregate in slavery and even in freedom. Some places limited religious access.
Mm-hmm.
So I would like to think that now is different in part because this happened in the church, first of all, and it happened to black people.
Mm-hmm.
And second of all, because it's past time for us to have this conversation about what is going on in this nation and race.
How do you feel? Are you angry? Are you hurt? Are you sad? Are you hopeful? Are you disgusted? Are you all of that? How do you feel?
All of it. All of it and more. I've been really upset and angry. I mean, I cried the first day, and I'm not ashamed to admit that, because I teach 400 years of this very fraught history of African Americans and their religious faith in this country. And so to see non-black people get shot when all they did was go Wednesday night Bible study, like, you know, millions of people do around this country, is mm-hmm. that Bible study, that's the one thing that everybody could agree with, Wednesday night Bible study, mm-hmm. whether you're a Christian or otherwise. People know that this happens in churches all around the country on Wednesday nights.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought to myself, how much hate do you have to have for black people?
Yeah.
You go in a church, you sit with them, and you listen to the Bible study, and that doesn't even move you. And you hate them so much that you shoot them and you hurl racial epithets at them.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm hurt, I'm angry, I'm disappointed in my country right now,
mm-hmm.
and I'm disappointed in the sense that I love my country so much. But these things continue to happen, and to the rest of the world, the things that we say about democracy and freedom ring hollow.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And I don't know how we get out of that. I would like to see us get out of this tailspin that we're in, but I don't know if we have a national resolve for that because we're so fractured.
And Theo, what else do you think it's important for our listeners, for all of us, to be thinking about in the weeks ahead in terms of this attack and the issues it's brought to the surface?
Well, I think the first thing is that if you are, you know, parents, you should talk to your children about this. And I mean this sincerely for any, whatever ethnicity or race you are, you need to talk to your children and begin to teach your children some different kind of history and to have them deal with nuance. One of the reasons why I wrote this article is that people don't seem to see what is happening. They just take things for granted. And we have to learn how to begin to think again. And I actually think there's a conversation here to be had about civic engagement. The way that Charleston has come out and come together, that it happened in a tragedy. How do we get more together in our communities and in our nation? That happens on the ground with civic engagement. Some of us have thrown off civic engagement. We're not interested in that. I think the other thing is to have a real genuine conversation about race and not be afraid to talk about that. It's difficult. It's hard work. I tell people when I teach my students that when I teach about slavery, you're either going to be mad or you're going to be sorry, or you're going to say it's not about me.
Yeah.
And all of those responses are valid, but that doesn't get to the point of what has happened because we had this history in this country. And then I think the other thing that we must do, and I say this sincerely, is that we must begin to push back on the narratives of the NRA
mm-hmm.
and others who keep saying that people are coming for our guns. You know, I grew up in a family that hunts. Nobody wants to take people's guns away. What we do want is some kind of place in this country where we can begin to grapple with this issue of rampant gun violence that
mm-hmm.
we have. Australia dealt with their gun problem, and it changed their nation.
Mm-hmm.
Why can we not do the same? Why do we have, besides the Second Amendment, we hold on to this gun thing so much as a symbol of freedom, but it's doing anything else but making us free? And then finally, and this is also really important, I think, white churches need to really get serious about racism.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the things that is most disappointing to me is that so many well-meaning evangelicals and fundamentalists and others don't feel like they have to have a conversation about race.
Mm-hmm.
They just want everybody to come into the church and, you know, we're all going to be together and it's happy. And that homogenization is not helping our issues. It's not helping spread the gospel. It's not helping do any of the things that they want to do. As a matter of fact, it's detrimental. And I think now is the time to get serious and really begin the search. And if your church is not doing what it should, if you look around you and, you know, there's no message about this and nobody cared about it and they didn't talk about it this past Sunday, you shouldn't be in that church. You should leave. If you are a thinking, caring person and your church did not address the church shooting and did not address the issue of racism in America, you should leave that church.
Dr. Anthea Butler is a contributing editor to Religion Dispatches. She's an associate professor of religion and Africana studies at the University of Pennsylvania. We will link to her Washington Post commentary from stateofbelief.com. Dr. Butler, I thank you for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Weldon.
I think most of us were inspired by the reaction to the bloody rampage at Charleston, South Carolina's historic Emmanuel AME Zion Church. And so I wanted to talk to people who are on the ground in Charleston who can help contextualize the way both immediate family members and the community at large put their faith into action so overtly and so immediately. Joining me now are the Reverend Ed Kosak and Cookie Washington. They led an interfaith vigil at the Unity Church of Charleston last Saturday. Ed, Cookie, thank you so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Would one of you please start by describing the unique history and current congregation of Unity Church?
Unity Church of Charleston was founded in 9/11/1983 by Reverend Marianne Finch. She is a black divorced woman, came down from Detroit, so she was a northerner as well, and founded the church. And then in 2002, I took over the reins and have been there ever since. Mm-hmm. And the church has always had a bit of a social activistic bent to it, with the outreach to homeless and that kind of thing, mm-hmm. and we've continued that with a very strong interfaith kind of action that mm-hmm. Cookie and I do together that we have been doing for several years now.
Cookie began by talking about the service that you all held last Saturday.
It was so healing and comforting and such a show of support that everyone in our community, our Buddhist brothers and sisters, and our Sikh sisters and brothers, and our Muslim brothers and sisters, we all came together in love and respect to mourn the lives lost, but to celebrate the fact that we are all one and we all have a heart for each other. Mm-hmm. For me, the most beautiful moment in the service this past Saturday was when my friend Dr. Reshma Khan, who is a Muslim who wears a hijab, stood up and spoke in her sweet, quiet voice. This Muslim sister spoke about the cross of Jesus and what it meant to her, how the cross vertically helps us to remind us to our relationship to God, and the horizontal bar of the cross reminds us of our relationship to our fellow man. Mm. It was so beautiful. And then a Sikh sister, Simran Singh, spoke so eloquently about how we are all family and how we are so much into each other's lives and into each other's community and how we have to embrace each other. It was just so remarkably loving and beautiful. We all spoke what we wanted to say to each other and to the community. I spoke about how much love there is and how much we have to reach for forgiveness, which can be so hard at a time like this, mm-hmm. and how we defeated the shooter's intent. You know, he shot those brothers and sisters in order to try to start a race war, and instead he started a love quake.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious as to why you all felt it was so important to do this right away, right after the shootings?
I know for one thing, there were several of our congregants here at Unity who were needing to be with each other and needing to be comforted, and it needed to happen as soon as possible. And, you know, you bring up a good point, Wilton. Maybe this is something we can do again at some point, because it's certainly not going to go away overnight. But it was a great need, and we provided an outlet, because I know one of the Dr. Khan, the Muslim woman, called me right away and said, Ed, what can we do? And that's so we got this together.
Have the inter-religious organizations there, have they also been multiracial in each instance, or is that a challenge yet to be achieved?
Absolutely. And the year before the anniversary of 9/11, I guess 2010, Reverend Kosek and I held our first interfaith action, and we had it at a park. It was actually had started out to be our church anniversary, and so we were going to have just a church picnic for our own congregation, which is very racially diverse. And then that crazy person in Florida said, I want to burn Qurans. And we said, no, we have to let our Muslim brothers and sisters know that we love them, we support them, and we are absolutely against this action. So we started with that one, and then September 11th, at the 10-year anniversary, we had about 800 people at an event, and that event looked like the melting pot of America. And again, we had speakers from, I think it was 13 different faiths, and even a pagan, a secular humanist. It was remarkable. The work here is going forward with people of all races and ethnicities, and I would rather say ethnicity.
Sure.
We're all one human race. We're all Homo sapiens.
I think our listeners would appreciate if one of you or both of you could tell us about last Sunday's service at Emmanuel Church and the courage and the defiance that were demonstrated by that.
It was remarkable. I have been to that church. I have very dear friends who go to that church. I was a friend of Pastor Pinckney's, and I have never been so proud of a group of people to open their church, not just to their grieving congregation, but to let in still being in a position where they could be fearful, they let in other people to come and worship and grieve with them. But it was a beautiful service with some sadness, but such a celebration of life and of unity and of realizing that we can overcome the hatred that spurred this young man to do this horrible, horrible act.
Yeah, and then Thursday service, I went to that one, which was at another AME church, and I was expecting to leave there sad or mad or something, and I tell you, our AME brothers and sisters, within a span of 15 hours, it hadn't even been a day when this young man did what he did, and they got this absolutely uplifting, wonderful service together that I walked out of there feeling empowered and strengthened and uplifted because of how they were up there. Now, of course, they're sad, and of course they're angry, and it's not like they're in denial about that, but it was like I was inspired, and I knew exactly what I wanted to say for Sunday, this past Sunday, when I had to talk about it in our church.
Are there lessons from this tragedy that other faith communities can learn regarding cooperation and mutual support?
I think so. I think that the lesson would be to reach out. You know, if you're at the grocery store and you see someone who doesn't look like you, give them a greeting of hello. Don't be afraid to ask questions. You know, I don't know very much, for instance, about Buddhism, but the Geshe-la who spoke with us on Saturday was more than willing, was thrilled to be asked more about his faith. And in turn, he asked more about my faith. And when we have these kind of intimate one-on-one questions, you know, right now we're coming together as a community to support Mother Emanuel's congregation. Mm-hmm. But in the days and weeks and months to come, I think we have to have more intimate kinds of talks mm-hmm. with each other.
This man did this act of hatred because of people's skin color, and while he was talking with them for the hour that he did before he shot them, he had second thoughts about doing it. And the reason he had second thoughts was because he got to know them, and he even said, "You're such nice people." Mm-hmm. And we do interfaith to get to know one another. We do interfaith to get to know each other's customs, scriptures, get to know each other and our differences, and to respect that in each other. And that's the purpose of interfaith. Is my wife's grandfather got up at a racial healing workshop we did, and he said, "Well, the reason y'all don't get along is because y'all don't know each other."
The Reverend Ed Kosak is the pastor of Unity Church of Charleston, South Carolina. Cookie Washington is a passionate interfaith activist and president of the board of directors of Unity Church. Ed, Cookie, thanks to both of you so very much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio and for doing what you do in Charleston every day of the week.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Bless
you. Thank you, Walton.
When Indian American Parvez Sharma made his award-winning documentary film, A Jihad for Love, back in 2007, the very idea of an openly gay Muslim was pretty new for most people. Since then, however, he has continued working as an activist, a public speaker, and writer at the intersection of those two core parts of his identity. Widely recognized as a leader in both the progressive Muslim and LGBT communities, Parvez Sharma has just released his latest film, A Sinner in Mecca, and I am very happy to have him with us now on State of Belief Radio. Mr. Sharma, welcome to State of Belief.
Thank you so much for having me.
Would you start by talking about why you decided to make your Hajj now and why you thought you should document it as a film?
The Hajj is the highest calling in Islam for all believing Muslims. I was done with coming out as a gay Muslim with my previous film. What I needed to do at this point in my life was to come out as a Muslim and to reclaim the religion on my own terms.
I'm curious as to the title. Why A Sinner in Mecca?
In Islam, you have the concept that all Muslims who go on the Hajj are sinners, and if they perform the Hajj correctly and in the prescribed way, then they are reborn almost, as the Prophet Muhammad said, and they're devoid of any sins. So I was just one sinner amongst millions.
But were you ascribing sinner to yourself just because of the gay identity, or you were actually reflecting on how other people saw you and how people saw each other on the Hajj?
I think it's a combination of both. Mm-hmm. And the gay identity, of course, is one part of it. But, you know, having led a life of mistakes, like mm-hmm. most of us do, mm-hmm. I felt that there was enough reason, and many reasons actually, for me to seek forgiveness in mm-hmm. Mecca.
What was the experience like?
Incredible, transformative, and life-changing. Mm. Very spiritual, of course, but at the same time, it's a very, very harsh pilgrimage that is fundamentally about faith and also about surrender. So you go through it, you're not just going through mindless rituals, you're going through rituals that recreate the journeys of Islam's ancestors, and the black cube-shaped structure, the Kaaba, which is the beating heart of Islam, is what is really special about the Hajj.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any moments in which you felt danger?
I was terrified before I went, even, because I was never sure that the Saudis would allow me into the country.
Mm-hmm.
My sins, quote unquote, are very public and just a simple Google search away. And by the time I left for the Hajj, I was probably the most public Muslim homosexual on the planet, really, mm-hmm. because of what I had done. So I was really surprised when the Saudis let me in. And then during the Hajj, I was terrified that I would be found out somehow and I would be outed.
Mm-hmm.
And my filmmaker self, of course, was worried about whether any of the footage that I was filming would make it out of the country.
Mm-hmm.
And I was not quite sure that that would happen.
So you really had one surprise after another that were very positive in nature.
Yes, I was a pilgrim, but I was also a filmmaker. And what took me on the Hajj as a pilgrim were very personal reasons. But my instinct to document the most important journey I would ever take in my life,
mm-hmm.
which is Hajj pilgrimage, was equally natural and very important.
How would you describe the changes that occurred in you because of the experience?
I think I've become more devout. I think I've become more aware about things that need to change within Islam. I think I can now confidently say that the Saudi regime and their version of Islam needs to go, and is probably the reason for all the bastardized versions of the religion that we see today. So I am able to speak confidently about these things that need to change within Islam.
Mm-hmm.
And I always say that real change within a religion happens when believers of the faith transform it from inside out.
Mm-hmm. If you were speaking to one of your gay friends in the Muslim community, or if you were speaking to a lesbian in the Muslim community who was thinking about participating in the Hajj, what advice would you give them?
I would tell them that it's very important that they go on this journey to discover their spirituality and to learn a lot from it. I would advise them, however, to be very careful and probably tell them, like I did, that there is a need to go back into the closet once you are on the pilgrimage.
Hmm. Parvez, I want to talk for just a moment more broadly about LGBT Muslims. Is there a supportive segment of the broader community? I know that recently there's been a surge in gay-affirming evangelical Christians where you would not have expected to find 10 years ago. Are you finding anything similar to that in Islam?
There are communities that are really small drops in the ocean almost,
mm-hmm.
but they all exist in the West primarily, and the majority of Muslims on this planet do not live in Western countries. So I am a little bit pessimistic about anything changing in my lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
I don't feel, for example, let's say the Pope and the Vatican
mm-hmm.
coming down with a ruling in our lifetime, saying that homosexuality is okay in the Roman Catholic Church.
Oh.
So now when you look at Muslims, and that's one-sixth of humanity, there isn't a pope in Islam.
Mm-hmm.
There is no centralized authority structure. So this idea of being gay or lesbian is not going to be something that you can find a theological solution for.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Sharma, I think you're earlier film, A Jihad for Love, was a powerful introduction to how LGBT Muslims reconcile these two identities. I'd like for you to talk briefly about that project and then how that contributed to what you were doing this time.
A Jihad for Love is a really important film. We estimate that almost 8 million people have seen it in more than 50 nations at this point. It has saved hundreds, perhaps thousands of lives. It changed people's lives. It really created enormous impact, even at the policy level of the U.S. government. I remember having screenings at the State Department and the Department of Homeland Security. So it did very well. It continues to travel. I still very frequently hear from people through social media that they were able to organize a private screening, let's say, mm-hmm. in Tehran, in Iran, or in Riyadh, in Saudi Arabia, things that would be inconceivable. So amazing things have happened with that film and continue to. And I think it's become an important agent of social change.
How did you explain what was going on with people on the Hajj who obviously saw that you were being filmed and you were filming? Was there curiosity about that, or were people so focused on the Hajj that they didn't mention it?
No, it was mentioned any number of times. I was not being filmed on the Hajj. I did it all by myself.
I see.
I had an iPhone and I had two cameras that looked like phones. Mm-hmm. That's how the film was made, because any depiction of the human form is forbidden in Wahhabi Islam in Saudi Arabia. There are no cinemas in that country, for example. I did feel afraid, but I continued to film. Early on in the pilgrimage, I remember that the religious police several times deleted some of my footage, but somehow, divine intervention probably, I was able to film even more as we went deeper into the pilgrimage.
I know that we have listeners who would love to know more about the film and that would be interested in trying to bring your work into their communities. Would you tell our listeners how to be in touch with someone about the film and scheduling it?
I would really encourage your listeners to visit our website, which is asinnerinmecca.com. We are really looking forward to taking the message of the film into communities like we did with the Jihad for Love. And I'm particularly interested in taking the film into academic settings.
Parvez Sharma is an openly gay Muslim filmmaker and activist based in New York City. His newest film, A Sinner in Mecca, has been garnering acclaim at documentary film festivals literally around the globe. Mr. Sharma, June is Pride Month in many parts of the world. We're also in the middle of Ramadan, and so I am particularly happy that we could highlight your work and your story today on State of Belief Radio. It's an incredible story. Thanks so much for being with us today on State of Belief.
Thank you. And it's not often that Ramadan and Pride Month coincide.
Now, before we go, through the magic of modern technology, Ray Kirstein produces this show while currently living in Germany. As remarkable as that level of global connection is, there is a world of difference among various nations in economic, cultural, and human terms. So even as most American cities have hosted LGBT pride parades during the month of June, as a matter of course, trying to do that in some other parts of the world is far more difficult and sometimes dangerous. Last weekend, Ray attended EuroPride 2015 in Riga, Latvia. I wanted to talk to Ray Kirstein about what a celebration of LGBT people in Latvia was like. And so this week, he's not only the producer for State of Belief Radio, he is a guest on the show he is producing. Ray, thanks so much for doing this.
Thank you very much, Welton. I'm happy to be here.
So what in the world made you want to go to EuroPride 2015, and what events make up that event?
You know, in all honesty, a couple of years ago, friends and I almost went to Baltic Pride, which was a pretty risky attempt to organize a march in Vilnius, Lithuania. I have family roots there. We kind of changed our minds at the last minute, and I've felt some regret since then. Supporting these rights in the United States is usually much easier than putting yourself on the line in other parts of the world, and I just kind of felt an obligation and also an attraction to the organizing that was taking place. There were two fascinating seminars, each one a day long, one about LGBT rights and human rights in Central and Eastern Europe primarily, and one about the role of media in communicating on these issues. EuroPride culminated with a parade on Saturday in Riga, which featured a reported 5,000 participants, plenty of people waving and smiling and giving the thumbs up sign. And by my count, one egg from protesters. So overall, not a bad ratio at all.
Well, that is great, because there were fears of violence ahead of this parade also, I think. But that evidently, things stayed peaceful.
You know, it was barely a month ago that the attempt at a pride march in Kyiv, Ukraine, resulted in injuries, some very serious, to police officers that were working to protect the handful of marchers against thousands of protesters, many of whom were hiding behind the facade of religious objection. And so it's far from a sure thing that something like this can be done safely. There were some protesters, a couple of signs that I saw, a few folks giving the thumbs down sign, but also plenty of people waving and smiling and giving the thumbs up sign.
How is opposition to gay rights there different than opposition to gay rights we see in the United States?
You know, the organized component of it is remarkably similar, and in fact, I think there's real reasons for that. Arguments are focused around making sure that traditional religious values are respected, and increasingly the argument is being made not just in one place, but quite universally in terms of children's rights. There's been extraordinary efforts made at the United Nations level in that regard. And unfortunately, a vast majority of the funding and strategy for that does come from the evangelical community in the United States, which is ironic because the anti-gay argument does tend to come down to, oh, look, this is Western secularism. This is corrupt moral values of the EU or of the West, or of the United States. We see that argument made everywhere from Europe to Russia to Uganda. And in fact, it is the anti-gay forces that are usually, if not always, inspired by and supported by the West.
I know you well enough to know you came away from that event with some really good experiences in your mind, pleasant feelings, but you also came away worried about some concerns that you noted. What did you come away worried about?
You know, as impressive overall as the level of organizing and arguments and activism is among both folks in Latvia and the various nations that were represented there, and there were quite a few of them, including, by the way, a contingent from New York that was marching in the parade. Several times during the seminars, the question was raised about religious influence, Western evangelical religious influence in the policies that we were talking about. And the activists almost universally rejected that as being less than important. They said we're primarily a secular society. This is not really something that the church is playing any role in. And ultimately, the name Scott Lively didn't ring all that many bells, considering he has been bragging about and fundraising around touring Eastern Europe and Russia and setting up organizations to fight LGBT rights in all of these parts of the world. It's a little bit disappointing that there is this, what I would consider overconfidence in terms of vulnerability to religious-based arguments and rhetoric in opposition to human rights and LGBT rights, which is something I think we've learned to take seriously in the United States.
Ray, what was the strongest impression you brought back from EuroPride 2015 in Latvia?
There was a real stepping out of silos. Again and again, there was talk about human rights being promoted in terms of women's rights, reproductive rights, LGBT rights, leaving behind the model where everybody is focused exclusively on their own agenda. And it does feel like there is a growing momentum both across borders and across issues to work together to make progress, to ensure both the rights and safety of members of minority communities, and to do that in a concerted way, learn lessons from each other, and again, engage folks in allied interest groups so that the numbers are greater and the message is consistent.
Ray Kirstein has been the producer of State of Belief since 2010. I can honestly tell you that his expertise in broadcasting equals his passion for what we try to do here on State of Belief. Last weekend, Ray took part in EuroPride 2015 in Riga, Latvia, and I'm delighted that he was willing to share something from that experience with us. Ray, it doesn't make sense to say thanks for being with us, because you're always with us, thank goodness. But thanks for turning on your microphone and sharing these experiences on State of Belief.
Thank you very much, Welt, and the invitation means a lot to me.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a very sincere thank you. For those of you who thought you would make it this week and didn't get it done, now is the time to not let another week go by without doing that. The ongoing financial support of our listeners is essential to keeping this show on the air. If you find value in what you're hearing, and if you think it's important that more people hear what you're hearing, I urge you to join our other generous supporters today. Please visit stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stateofbelief.com is also where you can sign up for our free weekly podcast and find links mentioned during the show. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter and share the stories that you find compelling with your friends. We really do need you to help spread the word about State of Belief. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. It's been a tough week, folks, filled with tears and anger, hate, forgiveness, moments of hope for positive change. There will be more of that, I'm sure. I hope this radio show has helped you get through the week a little bit better. That's why at the end of each of our shows, I say be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of government, religion, and politics. That's not a perfunctory comment. It is a really sincere hope. I say the closing words the same way, not as a perfunctory sign-off, but as a sincere wish. Until next week, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see, Welton.